This time on the show, sound guys are bitter.
Collecting a stupid amount of content.
And I'm a visual storytelling chemist. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show. I gotta find a way to say that more clearly. I trip on that one every time, Matt. Recorded live at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely, frigid Ann Arbor, Michigan. Comics.aedl.org. And this is the show where we talk about visual storytelling, making comics, drawing comics, writing comics, all of the things that surround this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Drozd, cartoonist and teaching artist. And we're going to talk about film today. What? Comics? That's not has nothing to do with film. Oh, au contraire. There's a lot to do with film. Comics and film share a lot of DNA, as we explored in episode 86 with returning guest Cole Glass. Hey, Cole.
Hey, how's it going?
Cole of EventideCreative.com. Emmy-winning director?
Director.
So
writer.
You're director and writer, filmmaker, right?
Editor.
Editor, too. That's right.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing right now. So,
What are you doing right now?
So the guys that I made Orc Wars with made another movie called Mythica, and I'm editing the first one. It's a series. And
Is it going to be a web series, or is it going to be for a cable network, or
it has been designed so it can either be 10 episodes or 5 features, and they're shooting 3 of them. They shot 3 of them to see if they should do the rest. So right now they're features, but I'm editing the first one.
I hope we can get to dig into that a little bit during today's discussion. You mentioned Orc Wars, so you're the director of Orc Wars feature, Der Ostwind, which we talked about in episode 86 of the show. But a guy who thinks a lot and very hard about visual storytelling. I'm wondering, for those who haven't checked out episode 86 yet, and you should, that's at comicsaregreat.com/CAG86. What is Orc Wars about? You described it as the Chronicles of Narnia in reverse, right? Or the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe in reverse.
Right, right. It's about how there's a portal between a fantasy world and our world, and then orcs come through and kind of a loner PTSD special forces guy has to fight them. He's kind of called as the guardian. It's fantasy stuff, but there's machine guns. That's all you need to know.
That is pretty awesome. And we showed some video of that while we were talking about it. So thank you once again for returning to the show, Cole. I'm really excited to talk about this with you today.
Thanks for having me.
What cartoonists can learn from the process of filmmakers. So new to the show, in studio, we have Donald Harrison. Donald Harrison, of former director of the Ann Arbor Film Festival, independent filmmaker. You make a lot of interesting kinds of films. You do documentaries. You do experimental films. You and our other guest, which I will introduce in a moment, you guys worked on a project with the University of Michigan Museum of Art, Many Voices. So you also teach film, too. Can you want to talk about the kind of stuff you do, or what you did at UMA, at the Museum of Art?
Sure. I sort of come from a documentary filmmaking background. In the last couple of years, I've been getting a lot more creative in terms of how you can approach documentary. And some projects have really lent themselves to exploration and sort of getting more involved in the teaching side of things. So the Museum of Art at U of M brought in myself and actually Sherrod, our other guest, to help run a project that had really great grant funding, foundational funding, to get 16 people in our community, some who had never made a film, some who were artists of other medium, and some who had made films, to each pick a work of art in the museum and then make a short video in response to it. So not about it directly, but inspired by that work of art. And then those videos are next to those, they're attached to, they're linked to those works of art in the museum. And so we saw a whole spectrum of ways to approach film and video and got to work with people at different stages. So it was very hands-on and very rewarding to work on so many projects all at once.
You and Sherrod, and we can introduce Sherrod now and talk about both of you guys together. Sherrod Patel, another filmmaker, writer, director, also musician at SoundCloud UFO Club 1977, right?
Correct.
And then you're at crop.com/Sherrod, too. But you guys worked together on the UMA project, and you guys were sort of like advising, teaching, and coaching these people who never made a movie before. That must have been interesting. I'm wondering if you guys like unboxed anything about your own process by working with absolute novices like that.
Definitely. I don't know. I would imagine Sherrod would say yes as well. I
mean, yeah.
Working with Sherrod, learned a lot in terms of how we approach things differently. And I'm excited about today's conversation, having people with sort of different approaches to working together, and, you know, found it very complimentary. But then working with people across all different types of movies. I mean, we had everything from animation to found footage mashup, narrative, documentary, experimental documentary, surrealist abstractions, films we couldn't classify anymore. And so, yeah, it definitely made me think about how I approach work, to see so many different people approach it in ways that made sense to them.
And that's why I kind of wanted to bring the three of you guys together for this discussion, is that I think that this is a good representation of how, you know, I teach comics classes, as many people who watch the show know. One of the hardest things, I think, for a visual storyteller to learn is what is their particular approach that works best for them. And, like, you know, there's lots of how-to books. Well, you have to write a script. You have to write a script before you can start thumbnailing. You know, and then some people say, no, you got a thumbnail, and then you'll find the script. And then, or, you know, some people go direct to final art, you know, and which is the right answer. Well, there is no right answer. You got to find that answer for yourself. And I think polling different creative people to find out what they do will help inform that. But I'm wondering, now that you're no longer director of the Ann Arbor Film Festival, are you able to talk about what a director of a film festival actually does, besides field email saying, why didn't you accept my film, jerk?
There's some of that for sure. I'm sure they're dealing with that right now, having probably just sent out a couple thousand notifications of people who didn't get in.
Yeah.
And, of course, now I'm on the other side, which has been fun. I finished up a film that I started 6 years ago with a friend out in San Francisco, and we thought it would be a fun project, sort of a mockumentary superhero action comedy. And it took us 6 years to make this fun little project, and we've been sending it out to festivals and getting the, hey, we loved your film, but
yeah,
we had so many to choose from, sorry. And then, you know, getting acceptances, fortunately, as well. So, yeah, definitely responding to the people who want it to be something else, or not happy about the fact that, you know, there's only 100 slots and 3,000 films. But, yeah, trying to remember everybody's name, that was one of the harder things, too, out of the couple thousand people you would know.
How many films do you wind up watching before the festival?
I think for me, I typically would review upwards of 1,000 of the 2,500 or 3,000. But we had an entire team, and they have 30, 40 people that are reviewing films for about 6 months. Labor of love.
Yeah.
And you see all kinds of things you never would have seen, and nobody probably will see, because a lot of them will not really be seen at any festival.
Well, there's always community television.
There's always the internet. There's always an audience, your friends, your family.
It's always YouTube. That's right. I mean, here I am, right? Everybody's looking at me on YouTube right now. Well, remembering names, I imagine that's a big one. And then just fielding that many videos. And reminding people who make things that for festivals, conventions, things like that, there's people running the thing behind the scenes. There's human beings who are doing their level best to sift through all this information and try to make a judgment call. So, yeah, a lot of different tensions going on there that I'm sure would make for a whole different discussion. But visual storytelling, that's what's on the docket today. So we have documentary filmmaker, experimental filmmaker. Sherrod, you do experimental films as well.
I do more. I mean, I guess I have more of a history of doing narrative projects.
Yeah.
Because I started from comics myself, you know, as a kid drawing comics. So I think I broke into movie making as an evolution from comics and from illustrating. So
that's funny. That's how Cole. That's how you got into filmmaking too, right?
Yeah. And you guys were giving me flack last time about giving up the dream of comics going for film, but
I don't think that was me. I think that was Jake more than anybody else. Jake Parker was on with you, and he was razzing you about that. But and actually, can we just put this one to bed right now? This whole idea of, because there's like this tension in comics about like other media, Because like a lot of superhero movies are getting made now, and like the right. general public says like, oh, well, that must be the trophy. If you make a really great comic, then right. your real vindication is getting a film. If that's the case for you as an artist, good on you. You got a film made and you're really happy about it. If you don't want to have a film made about your comic, you don't have to. One's not better than the other. They're just different mediums. Can we just like put that whole like tension and argument to bed, please? They're
yeah,
different
for
things.
Real. For real. And I think it's fine. Everyone has an evolution. You know, everyone has a path. Now, in retrospect, I think, you know, I was much more suited for film than comics. And so I don't regret. But, yeah, I mean, I started off wanting to be a comic book artist. And I just kind of found my way to film. And when I found my way to film, it made more sense to me. So. But I agree. Like every medium deserves the respect, and it doesn't, you know, they don't need to be stepping stones to the end all, you know, movie making. You know, I just feel like that doesn't serve anybody.
No, and I love celebrating what each one does better than the other, right? That's worthy of discussion, but to suggest that makes one better than the other, right? That one medium is superior is silly. That's just silly juvenile talking. And if you talk that way, you're a juvenile. Stop it. let's talk like grownups about this thing. So, as you guys, like Sherrod and Cole, I mean, if you guys started in comics, I mean, there's got to be a lot of shared DNA between the two mediums that you've seen in your explorations of both, right?
I think so. I mean, for example, when I watch a movie and I remember it, or I think or I evaluate a movie in my head, I almost lay it out like a comic book of all the frames or key moments that I remember. So I often go backwards in the way I think about movies. I kind of imagine them as panels or stills, and like, as did it make a good sequence? You know, did that movie flow well? And I think of it in terms of almost like a static chart sometimes.
Hmm. Yeah. Like the key moments freeze for you. Like
often, you know, and even in my own work, when I think about it, I think about, are there good, you know, like, could I pause my movie every, you know, few minutes or a few seconds and get a cool frame? Is there a variety in there? You know,
mm-hmm.
I think about it in a comic, in a graphic sense, you know?
Right. And then I would imagine also in visual composition and the cutting between shots. Like, for instance, you know, the example I use in my classrooms all the time with kids is you're watching Sesame Street, there's Ernie and Bert. Here's Bert, here's Ernie. And if in panel two you do that and they switch them, the reader's going to go, well, why did they switch? I didn't see why they suddenly moved. I imagine in a film you're worried about the same thing, the same kind of like blocking and arrangement of visual elements, right?
Yeah. It's called
I think they're really similar, actually.
Yeah. What were you saying, Cole? It's called what?
The 180 rule.
What's the 180?
Where you don't cross the line.
Oh.
Because all of a sudden some people will be looking, like if you shoot the whole scene, I'm looking this way, and all of a sudden I'm looking this way.
Yeah.
And Sherrod's also looking this way, then we're not looking at each other anymore.
Right. Okay. So stipulated.
We're going to break that rule the rest of the show now. Everybody start looking in different directions at all times.
I'm looking up.
Here we go.
To my left.
Experimental. There we go.
We're going to make an experimental film. So stipulated that comics and film have a lot of similarities. So then any naysayers who were like, oh, film, whatever. No, stay on board. This is going to be good. So what I'm curious about what you exploring in your guys' process is landing the idea, finding the narrative, right? You're on a walk one day and you have this moment of what Campbell called the aesthetic arrest, right? Like that such a place should exist, that such a moment in time should exist, and I'm one with this moment and I'm captivated by it, and I need to reflect that in the world. I need to express what this moment meant to me. That's not a narrative. That's inspiration, right? That's being inspired by something and excited by something. But how do you know the difference between what is something that arrests you and grabs you and something where there's a story, there's this idea, there's something to be – because even in an experimental film, you're expressing a narrative, right? I mean, it's not just pure, you know, Dadaism, right?
Well, actually, there's films that really stretch what a film could be about. and whether there is narrative. But yeah, there's some idea being expressed, and sometimes it is really to even deconstruct anything related to story.
Because limited aesthetic, we can talk about that film that people can find on your Vimeo page, which is this really visually fascinating, you know, intimate look at video game art with like audio from different people talking about video game art. And when I saw the film, and there was a structure, maybe structure, it was abstract, but there was an idea being conveyed, and there was, and it felt like it was an intentional journey through that exploration of that idea, right?
Oh, definitely. And I think for me, the more work I do, the more I'm starting to build off of what a documentary is and starting to incorporate more narrative pieces. But I think I also look at things a lot as sort of a mashup artist in the musical realm does, and sort of thinking in terms of these containers, these pieces and buckets, and sometimes being interested in seeing what happens when they collide together. Mm-hmm. So I'm almost maybe a little more of like a scientist in how I approach working with this raw material. Go collect raw material, have a theory or a thesis, and then see what happens when this we had a professor of color theory talking about this painting in the museum, and then we had actually Eli from the library talking directly about early classic 80s video games, and then we just mashed together their interviews in a way then trying to find the common threads and make it seem like they're in conversation even though they're talking about somewhat related but different subjects. And to me, that was exciting, to try to find the story within this material, not knowing exactly how, if it would work out.
So you're a visual chemist.
Ooh, I like that. You're a visual chemist.
A little bit of H2SO4 and some NaCl, and we get a story. No, actually, you know, this kind of heuristics, you're talking about heuristics, right? You're talking about like a little bit of trial and error. Like, let's put these things together. That's art, right? A lot of artists do that. I mean, Cole or Sherrod, can you guys weigh in on this? Do you guys do that kind of like mixing and matching of elements when you're trying to explore an idea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Settled. It's settled.
I mean, it's funny because as we were talking, I was thinking about it. Like when I was younger, in my 20s, I would come up with an image. You know, I'd have an idea for an image, and I was like, I got to write a story for this. And as I've gotten older and I've done this more professionally, I come at it reverse, where I'll think of an idea, like something will happen, or I'll hear a story, or I'll watch a movie, or you know what I do? I get a lot of ideas because I'll watch trailers and I'll misunderstand what they're about. And I'll be like, that sounds so cool. And then I'll find out the movie wasn't about that. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, well, I'll just write that story because nobody else has written it and I just misunderstood. So like, something like that will happen, and then I'll go back and try to get an image for it, like try to create the images. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's answering your question, but that's kind of how I think I try to play with it, where, you know, as recently I come at it way more from the side of like, you know, this is the story I want to tell, then how visually am I going to do it, as opposed to, you know, like, I'd have an image of like somebody in a robe jumping off of a cliff with a sword. And then I'm like, okay, what's this guy's story? You know what I'm saying?
Right. Oh yeah. 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 And I've worked both ways, and I found strengths and minuses to both ways, where I'll have an idea for a character in the way they feel and the way they act, but I don't know what they look like or what gender they are, or what, you know, if they're from another planet or whatever. It'll just be like, I need a sallow, smarmy person for this particular moment in what I want to do. Or I want a sallow, smarmy person to be the lead of this thing that I want to do. What are they? You know, are they a doctor? Are they, you know, a street manager of sanitation? What? And then other times I'll have like, I just drew a really cool looking robot kid, you know, like, right. I wonder what I could do with that. I wonder where the narrative is there. But both present different kinds of problems, right? Because I think, let me ask you guys, how does starting with an image, are there any dangers to starting with an image or starting with the idea first that you've run into personally? Like, not to say like, let's do a homily and preach to people. But like, have you ever run into a situation where, like, because I know I have, where I have an image that's really compelling, and then I'm so hung up on that image that I can't work anything into it, right? I've made a box that I can't fit anything into, and I just got this really cool image.
Sure. Just losing thousands of hours of time working on your project. That's all. I mean, other than that, it's not a problem. Yeah, I've encountered that. I mean, I think with documentary, you always hear these stories of the Metallica documentary. We shot 200 hours or 500 hours or 10,000 hours, whatever the case is. Well, then you're going to spend 2, 3, 4, 5 times that many hours going through it and figuring out how to turn that into a story. And so it's inherent to doing documentary that you tend to have a high shooting ratio because you want to just roll and capture those moments that aren't scripted. But then sometimes for me in my earlier projects, I would have an idea and I would sort of set certain conditions or rules and concepts into it that I thought were really interesting. And then I would sort of be very much sort of trapped by that and then having to do a lot more work trying to follow these certain ideas. And those didn't necessarily translate to the best film. So in my more recent work, I've been really looking at the ways in which I think in those rules or in those structures or concepts, and then making sure I'm not getting stuck in those and sort of breaking beyond that to make sure the work has life to it and you also get it done.
How do you not let yourself get stuck? How do you protect yourself from that?
You know, showing stuff to other people that you trust, I think, can be good. Working with people like Sherrod, who go, why are you going back and forth over and over? Like, that's the idea. Well, okay, but maybe it doesn't need to be that. So just having a few people that can help you sort of see those blind spots, I found to be very valuable.
I want to round off this idea of finding the narrative by talking with Sherrod just for a second about, so we showed some video from your film, An Apple a Day, which Donald informed me you made in 9 hours.
Yeah, it was one of those, what was it called? It was a...
Cinema Sports,
where you get an assignment. You have to, like, include certain elements in the movie, and you usually have a team of filmmakers. They get their assignment in the morning, and then that evening they screen what they made. But I did this one solo.
Okay, so were you given any other cues beyond, like, what was the assignment that you were given?
There was a time limit, I would think, and I had to include an apple, the opening of a box, and something old-fashioned.
Okay, so it wasn't like, oh, you have to do a story about, you know, alienation, right?
No, not at all.
No thematic constraints.
No, it was more like they gave you these specific, you could say, images or really literal kind of elements, you know, except something old-fashioned could be interpreted any way, right?
Could be you're drinking an old-fashioned.
Right.
Well, and I actually came up with those elements, so I hosted the event, and it was always interesting, and I hosted these a few different times, trying to come up with elements that wouldn't lead to the obvious joke. You know, you would just think of, like, oh, let's do peanut, like, they have to include peanut butter, and you're like, oh, man, it's going to be just... like the same gag over banana, or, you know, you're trying to figure out things that could be more interesting devices. So that was always a challenge.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, the trick is to not get too specific, but not be too vague. Right?
Exactly.
But okay. So then question, Sherrod, you got 9 hours to do this movie and you got these physical constraints. If you got to put these things in it.
Right.
How do you find the idea? How do you land on there? That's where the story is. That's where I got to get. Is it something where you're heuristing it, using heuristics, like, oh, let's play with a few different shots and see what happens when I look at them together? Or do you set out to, like, write out ideas? Do you take pictures? Do you doodle? Like, what's your process of getting to the...
It is a matter of coming up with compelling, like, looking at those elements that were required, quickly looking at what you could realistically do that day. Like, what could you photograph around you, because this is a video, right? Or what found footage or found images could you use? Quickly weighing that in and just coming up with some compelling way to represent those required elements, but then more importantly, flow from one to the other. And I think that's where the narrative comes from, is you have these different images or different elements. How do you connect them in time so that you're hit with one and then the other and then the other, and it makes some kind of emotional sense? I think that's called story.
Oh, some kind of emotional sense. I like that. I like that a lot, because, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be logical as long as it makes emotional sense. Right.
Right. Right.
Like you could have one of the elements, like, pass behind the character's head to represent that they're thinking about that thing at that moment, which is illogical, right, mm-hmm. visually. But if the context of all the other visual elements permit that action to happen, and if it resonates in some kind of emotional way.
Correct. And I think if you're going more in the experimental direction, then you really are dealing with not logical connections, but what reactions, you know, or what is this spark, you know, without having to think literally like story logic. But in my case, I made what is a very literal story, a very simple story, using those elements. I think what's funny, though, is when it screened, I remember, Donald, you actually said in the microphone, you said, did it have all the elements? Like you got into it, I think, and watched it and didn't even realize or didn't count if I had included all the elements or not.
Well, that's a good sign, right? That means that he was gripped by the story and not doing, you know, bean counting, or that you didn't that you didn't put a lampshade on everything. Like, hey, look at I used the thing, right?
Right. Which
a lot of them would do that sort of very obvious reference that made no sense in their piece just to include it.
Is it important to you guys that people don't think about what they're watching while they're watching it? Cole, I'm wondering if you think about that at all.
You know, there's something very magical about postmodernism, I think, that kind of calls attention to itself. I think that it limits the narrative. It limits the, I would say, emotional sense. Sure, it's this, you know, like it intentionally pushes people out. Now, whether that's intentional or not, it's fun when it's intentional. It's bad when it's unintentional. But I think there's a place for it. You know what I'm saying? I think there's a place for a wink at the audience. If it's right for your story. So I wouldn't throw a blanket on all of it and say, nah, you need it to be completely immersive. You know what I'm saying? Like the movie Gravity, you know, like I watched that movie and I was just, I was blown away by it, but I was also sitting there trying my hardest to figure out how they did that. You know what I'm saying? Like I wasn't sitting there going, I was so there, you know, I was in the movie. I was sitting there going, this is freaking amazing. How did they do it? How did they do it?
Yeah.
And I don't think that ruined the experience for me at all. In fact, I think in some ways it made it better because I was more impressed with it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like
I was more moved by the art of it. So I think there's a time and place, but again, you hope that that's a creative decision that you've made and not because, you know, like with Orc Wars, we had a review. Somebody wrote a review on IMDb that was like pretty scathing, and it's all about how you can see the bottom of the orc's shoes, and there's molded rubber soles, and this would be ridiculous for an orc to be wearing. That kind of stuff, you don't like. You hope audiences don't notice it, even though there's no way around it. I could not get authentic boots, right? Like that's just ridiculous. So,
yeah.
But I think you can, like, if you want, and if it's right, it's fun, you know?
I think of a movie I've talked about a lot of times on the show, you know, The Great Muppet Caper, where part of the conceit of the film is that they know that we're watching them make a movie. And so Kermit and where I think it comes to an apex is Kermit and Miss Piggy get into a lover's quarrel in the narrative of the story, and then they break character and get into another fight as an older married couple kind of fight. So like they have the young lovers fight in the narrative, then all of a sudden Miss Piggy breaks character, and then they get into a really big fight as, you know, like people who've been together for a long time. And I thought that in that context, it was brilliant, you know?
Yeah.
But, and then I also think of things like I just started watching that House of Cards show with Kevin Spacey, where he's constantly turning to explain what he's thinking.
Right.
By the way, that show's all about bad guys. Are there any TV shows where there's good guys as the main characters anymore?
Not anymore, but there's a book. There's a book called Difficult Men that's all about that.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, it's about how we have the television. It started with Sopranos, and it's mostly HBO shows. But I would recommend that book. It is really – it's a very interesting commentary on our current social situation.
Difficult Men.
Difficult Men. I can't remember who it's by, but I'm sure.
It just made me want to go back and watch Quantum Leap again, because I was like, I need to watch a show where a really, really good guy does nice things.
Yeah.
Because like everybody on that show is just so awful. And anybody who has any streak of goodness or tries to do good, ruin falls upon them. That's terrible. But anyway, so let's move on to talk about, like, okay, you got the idea. You found it. You found something where there seems to be a story in this thing. Now it gets to, you know, preparing to make it. And something that you've been kind of skirting around a little bit, Donald, is this idea of, and it reminds me of something a friend of mine, Rob Stenzinger of the Lean Into Art cast, Rob Stenzinger, interactive-storyteller.com. He just finished a book, an interactive ebook, which I'll link to in the show notes. It's at creativecodekit.com. And when he was making the book, the description he said is he amassed a stupid amount of content. Like, he just was buried in notes, explorations, sketches, potential scenarios, and workflows for the book, and inevitably discovered that, oh, the simple idea I had at the outset was actually the best idea. But he didn't know that until he amassed a stupid amount of content. So this presents some, you know, logistical challenges when you're making a film, right? I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about, okay, you got the idea, and then now we start amassing the content and how you sift through it. I wonder if we could start with you, Donald.
Sure. Yeah. No, actually, you made me think of a couple things. One is that sometimes it's that really simple idea that I made a film in 9 hours that ends up being better than the film. Maybe, you know, for me, I think the first film I ever made is maybe one of my stronger pieces. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't make it too complicated. I didn't try to do too much with it. In some ways, that sort of retained the most sort of creative spirit to it. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I think, you know, especially with film, there's so much technology that is often involved, and it makes me jealous of a lot of writers and graphic novel and cartoonists.
Yeah, I get to do whatever.
Right, and you know, of course, there's technology involved to some extent, but just in terms of, like, for filming it and then editing and obviously the expense of all the equipment, whether you're buying it or renting it, or finding ways to work around that. But I think a lot of times you can get lost in all of the technology, all of the different moving parts that you have to put together, and start to lose sight of sort of that inspiration and what will ultimately translate onto the screen for a viewer into the experience you want them to have, which maybe for your film is them getting lost and not even realizing they're watching a movie, or maybe it's them appreciating the process and the technique or whatever it is. But just having that sort of magic, that movie magic, come through on the screen is, I think, sometimes really tough to get through all those parts and processes. And that's ultimately, I think, what, for myself as a filmmaker, I've been working on mastering, is getting all those skills and those pieces worked out so that you can then ultimately translate your idea, your vision, your story for the audience. And easier said than done.
So when you're amassing this content, I mean, do you have any kind of guiding idea, or, I mean, is it just like, let's just shoot everything? Like, we're gonna show a preview of a thing that you're working on right now. You worked on with Sherrod, actually. Mm-hmm. And when you were putting together this, well, I wonder if we just switch to that now. Matt, can we pull up that video and we'll just sit quiet while it runs?
Yeah, who are the creators?
The Summer Game is a really powerful tool for engaging our community.
The Summer Game is probably almost as fun to make as it is to play.
That's one of the nice things about making clues, is that you can design a clue that's only 2 sentences long and have 3 or 4 different ways that people can come at it.
What's fun about it, there's the treasure hunt element, which, you know, humans love to hunt and gather.
There's something magical happening between the parents and the kids when the whole family can be involved as a team.
You have kids saying things to you like, this is so important to me. And what, I mean, how many 7-year-olds say that about anything?
Meet 7-year-old Suleiman.
What I like about the game is the researching, and I'm pretty much learning a lot more new stuff.
For us, it's fun because we hang out together, and, like, it's an alternative to just watching cartoons.
It's really fun, and it keeps me busy.
All right, so what did we just see? This was like a preview for the Summer Game launch at the AADL this summer, right? And we saw a lot of stuff in there. We saw, you know, interviews with librarians. We saw the inside of Eli Nyberger's office, which apparently is also the home of Sith Lords. And then there was, like, all these clips of things that were sort of, like, supporting the narrative in there. Like, there was clips from, like, Harry Potter and clips from other, like, old dinosaur films and stuff. So I'm curious, like, how do you arrive at that? Like, what did you just, like, well, we're going to have people talking, so we'll get a bunch of interviews. But then when you're, like, walking around the library and shooting video and then also the clips, where did that come in?
So, right. So that, and that was an excerpt from about a 3-minute educational promotional video that's going to come out next month for the library summer game. And I guess it's a, what, promo, edu promo? we'll come up with a word for that. But it's, for me, that was a great example of why I love collaboration with people who approach things a little differently. So Sheridan and I put that together. And, you know, we sort of had this very open-ended make a film about this summer game so people understand what it is. And it's actually really amazing. And so we sort of approached it from, well, we want to make this video also fun. The game's very much fun first, mm-hmm. and everything follows from there. And so then I think the result is really sort of the byproduct of Sherrod's creativity saying, hey, let's put them in the Death Star. I'm sort of imagining this room sort of having this sort of look to it and, you know, having the ability to do that. And so, you know, it's kind of a combination of some narrative and story and then also documentary and going in shooting footage of people that play the game and then weaving them into that. And so, yeah, I think it sort of combined both Sherrod's background and mine into one piece.
So you're talking about the aboutness of the piece. I mean, not to get too artsy about it, but I mean, you're talking about, like, what is this about? And then using that as a yardstick to measure your creative decisions within the parameters of the project. Does that sound fair? Sherrod?
I think the reason that you've got all these chaotic kind of elements that are somehow pulled in and somehow make sense when you watch it is because, I mean, my thinking was that's what the game is actually like. Like when Donald described the game to me and it involved a lot of trivia or it involved a lot of pop culture, I thought, well, why doesn't the promotion of it also take that same sort of form, you know, of like this whole landscape, unpredictable landscape of pop culture. So that was my reasoning, like my logic and the way in the style that it's, you know, of using all these different things.
So the subject matter too, right? Like, mm-hmm. so like looking at the subject matter, and just not about what it is, but also what it represents, what is the experience of the subject matter itself and how can I parallel or replicate that within the context of my project?
Yeah, exactly. The word parallel. Yeah. To try to parallel the experience of it. Cause I felt like that was just an interesting sort of a way to approach it that would kind of like be a fun guideline. And then, but it also like opened the doors like, well, then we can do anything.
but there's still a guiding idea there. There's still some kind of yardstick to like sort of check yourself against. Now I want to hear from the fiction storyteller in the room, the fantasy storyteller, Cole. Do you do anything similar to that when you're building your tales? Is like, what's the big idea? What's the yardstick? How do I check in on something? Because I'll tell you, I had a conversation with a writing partner once where I wanted to introduce three characters who were an inside joke to Transformers fans, and into the story. And like, these guys are going to do a walk on, and like the five Transformers fans who actually recognize this are going to laugh so hard. And he's like, well, what's that got to do with what the story's about? I'm like, nothing. He's like, well, then it doesn't need to be in there, does it? You know, and I conceded. I was like, okay, yeah, that was just like a self-indulgent thing I wanted to throw in. So I learned then that, like, oh, you got to have something to check in on, or do you have some other method that you use to check in on the process of the things you're putting it together?
You know, sadly, I would say the number one thing is just practicality. Mm. Just the ability, like what can you shoot? You know what I'm saying? Like with Orc Wars, they had the producers came and said, we want a dragon to fight a tank. And I said, that's ridiculous. And they said, no, that's what we have to have it. We feel like that will in a trailer is going to be very sellable. And so I was like, well, if we can make if we can get a taint there and it makes sense, you know, then sure. And so I worked on it and I felt like I found a good reason why a tank would be there. And then we're shooting, as we're getting ready to shoot, they're like, hey, by the way, we can't get a tank. And I was like, you told me to put a tank in there. You know, like, come on.
Right.
And they said, we can get a half track. And I had written the scene in a tank, right? Like a half track is like a truck. It's open. The tank is closed. You know what I'm saying? And if you're fighting a dragon, that's going to have different ramifications. The dragon could possibly blow on the tank and not hurt you. But in a half track, you're toast. So I had to rewrite. But that's kind of how it evolved. Like we didn't, you know, like it was, okay, it was a tank, but then it became a half track because we didn't have a tank. And the only reason we didn't have a tank, by the way, is because the people who own tanks in Utah, there's a lot of people who own tanks for some reason, like collectors.
Okay, I thought you were going someplace else with that.
I'm sure there's some apocalyptic people, but they don't talk about their tanks very often. But there are people, there are quite a few people, and they put them in the movies. You can rent them, but they only want them to be like authentic World War II type movies. Like they have their passion. They don't make their money by renting tanks. They're like, oh, I'll put my tank in there if it's, you know, an authentic World War II movie. Ours wasn't, so we couldn't get one. Anyway, so I think the practicality of it is large. I think that there's a place for kind of like you're saying, the references to Transformers. I think there's a place for that as long as it doesn't take away. I just recently saw a thing about how on a recent episode of My Little Pony, they had a Doctor Who pony and Rose, and they just walked by. And, you know, it went viral because everybody who loves Doctor Who, and there's some people who love My Little Pony and Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun nod, you know what I'm saying? But it's also like, how much time is it going to take? And, you know, in My Little Pony, they just draw it and it's no big deal. But what if, you know, like, what if I was going to do a Doctor Who reference in my movie with a character that I have to buy a costume? You know what I'm saying? Like all of a sudden it's like, I have to get an actor who looks like, and it just starts getting complicated for how much it's going to be for, you know what I'm saying? So I think the idea that does it serve the story is very good. Is it practical? Can you pull it off? Is another good, you know, these are definitely big guidelines, but sadly it's always like the budget, like how much, you know, how much you can pull off.
Actually, I would argue or submit, and I would love to hear you guys' reactions to this, is that those – I mean, a common theme on the Comics Are Great show is limitations breed creativity. Trying to get yourself out of a really difficult creative problem is where creativity really happens. And to just say to some young artist, you have an infinite budget, you have infinite time and infinite ideas, go forth and make greatness – it's not – well, first of all, it's impossible. That'll never happen. But second of all, it just seems like you're setting yourself up to fail more because you aren't hemmed in and have to fight your way out. And I think like when you talk about practicality, like in terms of budget, in terms of materials, the cartoonist is facing that with a page. Every page presents, you've got this much room. And you've got to tell this much story in this much room. And I just ran into this with a page I was thumbnailing where it's like, this moment is really important. Therefore, it has to be a big panel on the page. I have to give a lot of real estate to it because it's a really critical moment of the story. This smaller moment, more stuff is happening in it. I've got four characters talking in two caption boxes, and I've only got this much room. How do I make that work so as not to confuse the reader? How do I make this so it's not a jumbled mess? And I redrew that panel, I think, about six or seven times. And when I landed it, it was great. And I was like, I am a cartoonist, right? But that limitation, I could say, like, well, just an unhappy fact of life, kid. You can't fight City Hall. Sometimes pages are too small. Or you could look at it as, hey, guess what? I'm going to hem you in, and your ability to fight out of this little roadblock I put in front of you is your measure of success as a storyteller, right? I don't know. You guys run into this limitations thing, like creating brilliant new ways of looking at a subject that you never thought of before?
Yeah, I think when you're responding well to those limitations and when you're responding well to the failures, then by all means, I think that, you know, in the creative process for a lot of people, they then let that limit them. They let that. I mean, it's really up to you as an artist to figure out if you're gonna rise above that. And, you know, I think failure can be a really great inspiration, even within the piece where you went out and you shot this whole scene and it's a complete disaster, and then you realize, you know what, we're going to animate that, or we're going to do something else, or maybe we didn't need to do that, and you end up going in a different direction. This mockumentary I did with a friend, we had to rush into production, and it was mostly improvised acting with people who weren't actors. We outlined the story, and we just had a lot of holes. You know, some of the scenes, I mean, our cinematographer, you know, blew an entire scene where it all came out so dark we couldn't see it. And, you know, we ended up reshooting that scene. But, you know, we had to get creative to figure out how to fill these gaps and fill these holes. And, you know, ideally we would have had time and money to actually shoot it all the way we intended. But it just meant we took it in a different direction and ended up adding in some extra elements that were creative response to the places that we sort of fell short.
Yeah. And often an audience doesn't even know that that's happening. Well, ideally, an audience doesn't know all that stuff.
Ideally.
They don't see how the sausage is made, as they say. I know you have to go soon, Donald, so I want to... we're going to stick around and keep going for a few more minutes, and we got book recommendations coming up, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to say anything that you wanted to point people at, where people should, if they say, gosh, this Donald guy, he is a good-looking dude with a lot of great ideas, and I need more of this guy in my life, where can they find you online? Where can people find out more about you?
I think the best place would be my website, 7cylinders.com, the number 7. And I've got several projects that are getting completed this month, and so I'm excited to share like this library piece that Sherrod and I have been working on that's been a lot of fun. That's going to be released next month. And then a project I've been doing in collaboration with the Heidelberg Project in Detroit, the Museum of Art. And that's a project where I approached it very much sort of as a documentarian, collecting portraits of people and landscape footage, and then using green screen and some motion tracking and graphics. I'm mashing it all together with kids reading a rhyme. And it's sort of adding a lot of different creative elements together. I'm excited to get it finished next month and share it as well. So, yeah, I'd say my website's a good place to keep tabs on my projects.
And your 7cylinders on Twitter as well.
Yes.
All right. Well, Donald, thank you so much for making time to be here today. And I'll look forward to when the video drops of the summer game trailer. And I hope to have you back to talk longer about this subject.
This is great. Thanks for having me on, Jersey. And good to meet you, Cole and Sherrod. I'll see you soon.
Donald, thanks.
All right, so while Donald leaves and Rachel comes in to do book recommendations, I had another couple questions, quick ones for you guys, Cole and Sherrod. Two things that I think get overlooked a lot in a lot of visual storytelling are color and sound. And I know those got to be important to filmmakers. So I'm wondering, I start with Cole, how important or how do you approach thinking about color and or sound when you're working on your projects? Because, I mean, especially in a fantasy story where, like, the dragon's only going to be as authentic as the full presence.
Right, right. Color, just color real quick, is something I've never... It's interesting because with film, you can do a lot of things after the fact on both sound and color. You can shoot stuff. And you're like, this looks horrible. And then the colorist gets it and it looks great. You know what I'm saying? And it's hard. I still struggle with seeing the potentials of what the colorist can do and cannot do.
Yeah.
But I have been thinking a lot more about it lately just because I feel like it is important. And I know that there's a lot more to learn. So I don't really know how educated a comment I can make on color other than I think it's super important and probably doesn't get enough thought.
I also think color gets too much gravitas when people talk about it as well. I think there's a balance between, like, because sometimes it's like, I want this to feel happy. What color are we going to use? Well, we're going to use warm colors, right? You know, you don't have to necessarily have, like, a degree in color theory, although some people would argue that. But it's just, I was curious if this is something that in your process of making a thing, if it's on your mind.
You know, I think it is, but a lot of times, well, the nice thing is that you can hire like production designers who will generally know more about color than you, or at least me. You know, so it's and the same thing with cinematographer, but a lot of times when you're working at a low budget, you can't really design a lot of things. You can add things, sure. But when it comes to, you know, like, a lot of times a lot the color that you have control over is like what the character, your main character, is wearing and what you want to, you know, do they wear warms, you like you said, cools, you stuff like that.
Yeah.
But flipping over to sound, which I think is very similar in the way, like, it's funny, we were making a joke the other day about how sound guys and sound people, I've rarely worked with a sound woman, but I'm sure they're out there. Anyway, they tend to be really angry people.
And really?
Yeah, like, I mean, I know a few that are just awesome, but for the most part, it's like they get really frustrated because they feel like sound is an afterthought, which it is, and it shouldn't be, but it is. And a lot of times you're just trying to get your shot, you're trying to get it, and the sound guy's like, I can't get close enough, I can't get good sound on this. And you say, don't worry about it, I just got to get the shot. And they get really angry, and they feel like they're secondary citizens on set. And I think that prevalent attitude kind of shows how we don't think about it. And then once we get into the edit room, we start thinking about it. And so I definitely think, like color, it can be thought of a little bit more, but it doesn't get a lot of thought because you don't have to deal with it in the moment. You can come back and you can hire a sound guy, a sound designer, and you can come in and, you know, like when we were designing the orcs, you know, I was like, use a tiger, we kind of took a tiger and then we took an alligator and then, you know, like we kind of built it, but I had time to just sit on the couch and have the sound guy pretend, like try. And then we finally said, oh, that's good. But on set, you're just like, how bad was that train in the background?
Yeah.
Oh, it was okay. All right. Well, let's move on. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. There's...
So I don't know. Like, I feel like, I mean, ultimately in the end they are, but because they're not right away, because they're not like right in, like when you're shooting, they get pushed off to post-production. And then again, it's just, you know, hiring somebody who's good, who can build your world for you. So
I would argue that's very similar to the way comics are often produced, where the coloring happens at the back end, right? There's a penciler and inker, or pencil inker artist who does the line art, or even if they're their own colorist, they do the coloring after the fact, right? And then the lettering is all done later in the game as well. So a lot of the sound design in comics is done on the back end. You don't have to think about it much. And you don't, because like one of the things that I get, you know, really jacked up about is when I'm reading a comic where the sound elements, meaning the word balloons and the sound effects, all contribute to the overall composition. And they contribute in a way that makes logical sense in the context of the story, where it's communicating the intonation and quality of the noises going on, whether it's somebody's voice or whether it's a sound effect. So when I see that all happening well, I get super excited. But then when I see somebody just like, oh, you took the font impact and they kind of put it crooked and made it red, that's not good sound design. That'd be the equivalent of just getting like a public domain sound bank off the internet. And when somebody falls down, you hear that Hanna-Barbera bang effect, right?
Right, so, right.
So whether you're thinking it up front or in the back end, it's like something I think a lot of beginning storytellers miss out on, is they think of color and sound as ornamentation, to quote my friend Dan Mishkin, rather than as like an integral part of the overall storytelling experience. Sharon, I'm wondering how hard you think about these two things now that I just blew them up into massively important things.
Oh, wow. No, I think they're so important. And, you know, I come from a background in illustration and painting, so I often like will watch my edits with the sound off, just to check out visually how it feels. And at the same time, I'll listen to my sound mixes with no image to see if I can still get a feel for the environment and the story. As a matter of fact, I'm doing working on the sound mix of a feature length narrative right now. And I actually mute all the dialogue and watch the scenes with all the sound effects and all the environmental sounds in there. But if the characters' mouths are moving, nothing's coming out. And I love watching it that way to see how it feels, you know? So I'm really starting to pay attention to just how important that is. You know, audiences are used to Hollywood-scale soundscapes and Hollywood-style color grading, you know, color styling in movies. And I think it's important for people who are working on an independent level to realize that if they put some time into that, it really, the quality, the perceived quality of their piece increases, you know. Whether the audience even knows it or not, that's what they're appreciating. They do appreciate it.
No, that's what you just call like production values, right?
It's like, right, yeah, right. Production values. I mean, some people, you know, literally think of production values as the props or the costumes, right, you know, that are there when you shoot. But yeah, definitely the sound and the post production, the styling that you give it. Yeah, but you bringing up coloring in comics is so interesting because there's been so many comics that when they first come out, like, at least a while back, they'd come out, you know, monthly issues that would be black and white, and then they would put out a compilation where the whole thing gets put together and then color, mm-hmm. you know, and so, and there's a huge difference there in the drama, I think. I mean, there's strength to either one, because you interpret colors if something's black and white, and there's strength to letting your audience interpret things, because then they make it personal, you know, they fill it in with colors in their imagination that you could never get to. But yeah, you know, the controlling of the color by putting out a comic in color, you can really, like you're saying, a happy scene, you know, in the most basic terms is warm, or if something is desolate, it's cold colors, you know, that yeah. that stuff really works.
Yeah, and I also think of that joke of you know, how all action summer blockbuster movie trailers now use that bwom sound.
Yeah.
A friend of mine recently said, like, every summer blockbuster film trailer, they got the lights off because everything's always really dark, and, yeah. and they, all you hear is that giant tuba noise. Like, that's like the signal of summer blockbuster movie, and it's like, well, we found out what works after all, I guess. But it's like, it's what are they trying to sell you? They're trying to sell you, this is going to rock you to the core. So what do? They use these big, deep sounds, and they use all of these gray, muted tones, right? Cole's right. nodding enthusiastically.
Right.
It's so true. It's so true. And it's, I mean, I think Inception was the first one that did that.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the legacy.
Yeah.
I just saw the Godzilla trailer, and like, I was like, oh, there it is. Oh, no.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think I like putting a little hat on that one and saying, like, hey, color and sound are critical parts of the overall storytelling process. And I also like the idea of, like, I'm wondering if you guys do this with your actors, with pacing, with dialogue. Like, okay, can we try it His Girl Friday style? Can we try it slower now and seeing how, like, because one of the things that I find in my own work is when I'm thumbnailing a scene is the dialogue will not necessarily be fully formed yet in my head, but I'll have a sense of the rhythm of it. And it's almost like I'm listening through a door. Like, I'm hearing, like, it's really silly to say, but like, that's how the dialogue pacing feels to me before I even know exactly what is being talked about. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you guys mess around with that when you're doing your films too, like having them do multiple takes of different speeds to see how it adds or subtracts from the scenes. Cole?
Yeah, it's funny because, like, even on, like, this film that I'm editing, you know, you only get about three takes just at your current rate. So a lot of times that's like, you sit down and you talk. Like, I always call my actors and say, this is kind of how I see you, you know. Or even in the audition, you know, you're like, I see this guy being like this guy, and, you know, to give them some frame of reference. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely times where, I have them, you know, like, okay, I need you to slow down. I need you to say this faster. I think that the idea that comes to me is like, David Mamet, I think it was David Mamet. He would use like a metronome, right? Like, and he would have his actors having this ticking in the background as they, you know, and they would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. And if you watch his stuff, he has like a very, very specific cadence. Like, everything is, it's almost as if there is a metronome ticking away. I have never gotten to the point where I've always kind of wanted to try that. I always wanted to see what that would bring forth in an actor. But I think at the end, you're just, you know, it's a lot on the characterization. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think that's probably what you're talking about, is you hear a certain pacing, that's probably informed by the characters that you're, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
All characters don't talk the same speed.
Sure.
And so, you know, you're hearing it because you're hearing these two characters are making music together. And you're not sure what they're going to say, but that's kind of, I would say the characters are probably more informing it than.
Oh, that's like, a great way to put it, Cole. The characters making music together in like the tone, intonation, and pacing and cadence. Oh, that's so good. Because like you can have harmony and you can have cacophony, right? Depending on what you want to get out of the scene and depending on what the characters' motivations and reactions are informing in that. Ooh, I love
that. And then you get in the editing room and totally change it.
I wanted to give Sharon a chance to respond to that initial point before we switch over to book recommendations. So is this something you mess with as well, Sharon?
Definitely. But, you know, on an indie budget, like you were saying there, you know, you get three takes. You don't have the room to do all variety or all versions of the scene that could possibly form from all your different creative, you know, people there. So what I do sketches of the scene beforehand, like the week before. I'll get the actors together, or even if I can't get the actors, I'll get stand-in actors and actually do sketches of the scene. And we don't even have to go to the real location. It could be in the living room, and I'll shoot those and watch them and try to figure out, you know, oh, where can this go? So I do like that playing of, you know, letting them improvise or switch up the pacing or even add lines, subtract lines. But on an indie budget, I end up doing that in rehearsals more so than on the actual set. Yeah,
that's pretty dang smart. I don't always do that, but I think it's a great idea.
It's a good idea for a dramatic scene. Like if it's an important scene, it's a good idea, I think, you know. Yeah.
Well, and from a cartoonist standpoint, that would mean just sketch it out on paper, you know, make
right.
sketches on paper of the scene, a variety of different gestures and poses and so on. Yeah.
Right. From a musician standpoint, it would be the same thing as a jam session and a demo, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. The parallels are all the way there. It's just trying to convince my young students to draw a page three times is always tough.
Oh yeah.
You gotta draw three times. Like, yeah, you gotta do a little tiny thumbnail, a bigger thumbnail, and then the full page. Aw, nuts. So, all right. Well, you know, I mentioned you guys perhaps early on that we were going to be doing book recommendations. You guys don't have to do this, but if you have some books that you would recommend to people, now's the time to think about them. And then I'm going to kick over to Rachel Moyer of the Ann Arbor District Library, comics.aadl.org. You're kind of doing more and more of the comics programming now. Oh,
I'm glad to be here. Oh, yeah. In this
there we
microphone,
go.
It's like an ongoing battle. Okay. But yeah.
So hopefully more, even more.
Fingers crossed. It's a lot of fun.
You're going to be around for Kids Read Comics this summer, yes?
If not in an official capacity, I'll be here just because it's fun.
Okay, cool. Okay, good. So, but yes, you are also, you not only were conscripted into doing the comics programming, you are a huge comics nerd. And if people follow you on Twitter or any place else where you post things, Tumblr, yes? Not as much?
Nah.
Well, they'll see that few people love Lois Lane the way you love Lois Lane.
It's one of those things where I start to get a little embarrassed if I talk about it too much. But yeah, I could go on tirades. It's a thing.
I've openly admitted that I go to Transformers conventions on purpose. You can admit how much you love Lois Lane in public.
Oh, it's not so much the love that is embarrassing. It's just the babbling that ensues afterwards. I don't mind admitting how nerdy I get. It's just
okay.
The stream of word vomit that comes out just kind of knocks people over, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So you just be careful about how you talk about it in mixed company. I understand that. All right. So what do you got to recommend for people who are interested in the discussion that we had today? What comics should people be reading?
Well, I tried to keep a movie theme going here. It might be a little tenuous. but the first book I have, and I'm totally cheating. This is actually the sequel for my visual aid because I don't have the first book available to me right now, but it's Whiteout by Greg Rucka and Steve Lieber. It's it had a movie adaptation, which is my movie length here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The movie adaptation was pretty much panned universally.
Oh, that's too bad.
Which is interesting considering that the book was Eisner nominated. So.
But, oh, the source material is fantastic. Steve Lieber's storytelling? Forget about it. It's great.
Right. It's a fairly straightforward murder mystery, but it's made extra interesting by the fact that it takes place in Antarctica. It features a U.S. Marshal by the name of Carrie Stetko, and there's a science outpost there in Antarctica, and someone turns up dead, and it's a very tense story that is unsurprisingly in black and white. Yeah, yeah. Antarctica crime. Not surprising. But it is a good study in a really muted kind of story. Everything is made more tense by the fact that it is in black and white, that it doesn't have sound. We're talking about sound here. I think it actually works better in the comic medium because it is silent medium. So to get a little art nerdy about it.
Well, and also Rucka's dialogue style is more reserved in Whiteout than compared to things that he wrote for DC Comics,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's very reserved. There's not a lot of back and forth. There's, I guess, a little bit maybe more voiceover narration, but even that is just very sort of staccato, I think.
It's been a while since I read it, but I remember it having a lot to do with, a lot of the story was about her sense of isolation.
Very much so. The ice, as it's called, Antarctica, is very much a present character in it. It's very much about this isolation, and not just isolation in terms of being away from everyone, but being isolated in that the main character is not well-liked. There's rumors going all around that she's there because she killed someone. She's there because, you know, her career is totally on a downward spiral. She's kind of exiled from the United States, as it were, with this position. So it's internal isolation that kind of projects itself on the environment as well. So it's a pretty tense read.
Yeah, and also talking about limitations, you're dealing with a landscape that is just white, and you got to make it look visually interesting, and Lieber pulls it off. So next I see a book that I recognize.
Talk about a 180. tense isolation to colorful 1980s humor superheroes.
Justice League International.
Yes, Justice League International. This collects the first six issues of Justice League, and then it became Justice League International after that.
Now, we should say, like, for context, because Justice League has had a lot of iterations.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So this was in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. It was coming off of Justice League. Before that was in Detroit.
Yes.
Run by Martian Manhunter and characters like Vibe and Gypsy and so on. But then along comes Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, and Kevin Maguire. They reinvented the Justice League after a big event called Legends.
Right.
In the
and
80s.
This is what you might hear called the Bwahaha years of the Justice League.
Yes.
This is the Justice League with a lot of humor and kind of interpersonal problems going on. This is where you're going to have Blue Beetle and Booster Gold being like the, you know, buddy sitcom stars of DC and all that. And I absolutely love Kevin Maguire's pencils. This is my tenuous movie connection here is the acting. We've had this conversation before about how when you're doing comic art, it's great to, you know, think of your drawings as your actors and to try and have them perform for you in the same way with body language and facial expressions. And Kevin Maguire, he has pretty unique stylings. This is a pretty famous couple of pages here.
Yeah,
Batman punching out Guy Gardner. Well, if you look through his work, what you'll see is he renders facial expressions that aren't always the prettiest, but are pretty realistic. And they changed the pacing and flow of the story quite a bit. The art really works for the story. And, you know, I'm not talking about the story itself very much here, but Justice League International is pretty great too, just for the humor. If you want to read a superhero story with the team dynamic that is, you know, not so much grim and gritty or trying to be, you know,
and not necessarily big bombastic fun either, because there's like a whole issue where Guy Gardner and Ice go on a date and Blue Beetle pranks him. That's the whole story.
Yep,
there's no supervillain in that one.
Right. And then you've got, you know, Booster Gold and Blue Beetle setting up their resort.
That's
frequented by supervillains and all that. So it's
sort of like Seinfeld. It's like Seinfeld
is
a superhero story.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what made it so great. But what, I'll underline what you said about Maguire is he can make a character go, yeah, well, and he can capture that emotion with a curl of the lip. And you don't have to use dialogue because he gets it out of his actors in the comic. Yeah. All right. So now we've got Star Wars.
All right. And okay, I'm not going to explain that movie connection. That's pretty obvious. This is Star Wars Tag and Bank Were Here, which collects two series, which are Tag and Bank Were Dead and Tag and Bank 2. This is basically Star Wars meets The Life of Brian. If you're a Monty Python fan or you just really like humorous references, or if you just love Star Wars, this is a great book to go to. And the art is extremely expressive. Like, here's one of the covers from the book series. You can see that they have a very animated set of expressions. But basically, it follows around these two characters named Tag and Bank, who are behind the scenes in pretty much everything happening in Star Wars. And it's a lot of, like, them tripping up and accidentally causing a lot of scenes that happen within the movies.
Yeah, so it's also a little bit of
ever showing
Gump.
Up. Yeah, it's,
yeah, yeah,
it's a lot of good fun.
Yeah, it's a pretty funny comic series. And that's from Dark Horse. Mm-hmm. Tag and Bank Were Here. All right, well, thank you, Rachel. Are there any events coming up at AADL that we should know about? The next forum is April 4th, yes?
April 6th, actually.
April 6th.
Yeah, and that's Joshua Hoke, I believe.
Joshua Hoke is going to be here to talk about Tales from the Brothers 3.
Yeah, that should be fun. I believe we also have an event that might be of interest to folks this Saturday, which is a computer animation character design workshop. That's going to be here March 8th. So if
Do you know what program they're using?
You know, I'm not sure. I know it's the folks over at GameStart who are teaching, and that's, you know, Teens It Up. It should be interesting.
Yeah, 3D character design. Very cool. I'm guessing it's something like Blender or something like that. But
you know, I'm not even sure if it's 3D. I think it's more focused on the visual programming part of it. So it may even be something like Scratch. I wish I knew, but
okay,
it does sound like it's an event series.
Okay.
So
it's at AADL.org.
Yeah, check AADL.org /events, and info's all there.
Also, Mini Comics Day is March 22nd at the Duderstadt in Ann Arbor at North Campus. So that's at lib.umich.edu/Mini Comics Day. Just search for Mini Comics Day Ann Arbor. We're going to get together for 8 hours and try to do an 8-page mini comic in that 8 hours. So I'll be there. You should be too. lib.umich.edu. Okay. I got to respect people's time here. We're already way over time. Sherrod and Cole, did you guys have any book recommendations you wanted to make, or do you just need to get out of here?
I was going to say, this might be obvious, but I just finished reading Sandman for the first time.
For the first time?
It rocked my world. I was watching, The Wire during the same time period, roughly, and I was like, kind of struck at how similar they were. In just the fact that they kind of didn't really stick with one, you know, like The Wire kind of drifts off into different side characters, as did Sandman. So I thought that was great.
So Sandman deserves the praise it gets.
I would say yes. And I kind of feel like I saw a lot of the roots of comic series now, like Fables and other series like that, where like definitely were rooted in Sandman. So it was fun to see. So
Neil Gaiman's Sandman. Fables is also great.
Fables is fantastic.
Bill Willingham's Fables. Have you ever read his stuff he did in the 80s, Elementals? His superhero deconstruction series? It was basically it's pre-Watchmen. Maybe it was post-Watchmen, but it's very well, it's like if somebody did an HBO superhero show where not everybody's very nice and everybody has real problems, and it's done in the way that Bill Willingham does it. So Elementals is great.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I love Fables, so
yeah,
for sure.
Elementals is that treatment on superheroes. So Sherrod,
anything
that you would recommend that people go check out? To not necessarily a comic, but it could also be a book on like this particular discussion that we had.
Well, I mean, it's funny because you're talking about a Star Wars offshoot comic. I was going to bring up, there's a hardcover book. I think it's out in paperback now. It's The Making of Star Wars, the definitive story behind the original film. And it is a meticulous, detailed book that talks about the whole process of where this movie came from, you know, in the early 70s, through all these draft story drafts, to the casting, to the production, to the editing, and all the problems. And I mean, it's coming from the perspective of like, a lot of research and interviews. So it's just filled with the good and bad that went into what ultimately became like, one of the most successful movies, and stories, I guess you could say, of all time. I would recommend that.
Huh.
Based on my perspective coming from narrative film.
Yeah. And the title again was?
It's The Making of Star Wars.
Oh.
The definitive story behind the original film.
All right, cool. guys, I can't thank you enough for all the time that you gave me today. Thank you guys so much for hanging out with me and sharing all of these great thoughts on storytelling. So let's go around the horn and give everybody a chance to say what is the one thing that you hope people will check out today. Cole, what's the one thing that you hope people will go and click on upon leaving this podcast?
In general, like in life in general?
No, for you, that directly benefits you.
Oh, I would say check out my Twitter. It's kind of become my central hub. I don't update my website as often, but my Twitter, which is just Cole Glass, twitter.com/ Cole Glass.
K-O-H-L, glasses.
Yeah, K-O-H-L like the store.
And then glass like the transparent material that we have on our houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And yes, you do post lots of sometimes very comical things and sometimes philosophical things.
Yeah. It's funny because that kind of started, and it still is, where I kind of like sometimes I'll think of a funny line with no story or character to attach it to. I throw it on Twitter.
Oh, and do you watch the reactions to those to measure how effective?
I do. And here's the funny thing. I prefer Twitter over Facebook, but I have way more response on Facebook. So
interesting.
Yeah. And sometimes people are like, oh, you can't say something like that. Like, don't be hard on yourself. And I'm like, oh, that wasn't really me talking, if you know what I'm saying. But
you need to put quotations around it.
I don't know.
Oh, interesting. No, I see. I just took it as you just playing around
yeah,
with
well,
text.
It is. I mean, it is. But there have been times when I'm like, I need a funny line. So I get on my Twitter and I start scrolling through to see if I had one that I remembered.
That is pretty cool. No, I do something very similar with Instagram where I will post, like, I'll take excerpts of the sketches where it's like, I think there's something here. There's something in this sketch that I did, but I don't know for sure. And I'll post it to Instagram. How do people react? Do people react positively, very positively, or not at all? Okay, well, not a lot of people thought anything of that, so I guess I can put that one away. So,
right.
But that's easier. People don't think that I'm actually expressing anything about my day when I draw a robot girl pouting, you know?
Right.
That's funny.
But like yesterday, I tweeted about how I would prefer to create naked. Yeah. It's not true about myself. I can't do anything without pants on. But, you know, like I thought it was a funny thing to say, you know, and like on Facebook, people are like, oh, like there was like a lot of comments on like my morality and stuff like that. And so I was kind of like,
seriously, you know. Like people were like, oh, shame.
Yeah, like it was kind of like people thought I really believed that. And so I was like, well. And I don't correct them. I let them believe it. That's fine.
Finally, somebody who uses Twitter and Facebook right.
Not serious at all.
So Cole Glass on Twitter to hear him write about being naked. And then Sharon, where can people find more of your stuff? Where's the one thing that you want people to go visit today?
I think if you just look me up, if you look up my Twitter account under UFO Club 1977, you'll find the link to my website, which is sharadcamppatel.com. where I have links to a lot of my short films and work, and it'd just be great to have comments or just views.
All right. So, yeah, people can interact with your stuff there.
Yeah.
And thumb it up. Speaking of thumbing it up, if you guys are watching this on YouTube, you know it'd be a great way to support the show is give a thumbs up. That helps more people find the show. If you're listening to the audio podcast, go to iTunes, give us a star review, however many you think we deserve. I think we deserve a lot. And then I appreciate that. I really do. I look at the reviews, and the nice ones make me feel really, really good. So if you want to make Jersey feel really, really good today, that'd be a great way to do it. Rachel, anything else that you wanted to promote? Any place that you wanted people to say where they could find you or no?
Well, I have a Twitter account, which is Rachel J. Moyer at Twitter.com. I can't say that it will all be on topic to this kind of stuff here.
No.
Not at all. But if you want more relevant information, I would direct everybody to go to AADL.org or comics.AADL.org, where we have a lot of blog posts with more recommendations and information on our upcoming events that might be of interest to folks that like this kind of thing. So
very cool.
Go there.
All right. But if they want to hear about Lois Lane, they could follow you up on Twitter.
Yes, they could.
when you watch an episode of
anything.
I was going to say Smallville, and then you get mad, and then you start firing off like a long, 120 tweet missive about Lois. Yeah. I find it entertaining. thank you, Rachel, for the great book recommendations and for all the help with comics.aadl.org. Thank you to Cole Glass and to Sherrod Patel. And to Donald Harrison of 7cylinders.com. Thanks to Matt Dubay in the control room for putting on this show every 2 weeks. Thanks to Eric Kloster for monitoring the chat and collecting all the links that we talk about during the show. This show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG 94. And we will be back in 2 weeks. And until then, I've been Jersey Droz of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.